is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Halbrooks, Judge Larkin, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. Today, March 7th, 2019, we have six cases on our calendar today. One of them is non-oral. And one of them will be in this courtroom, but by ITV. But our first three cases are here in a courtroom, or four cases with attorneys present. So let's begin with the first one. It is A180713, Kathleen Marie Wilson versus Todd Joseph Wilson. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary arguments, counsel for appellant, 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you choose to use it. Go ahead, take the podium. It toggles up and down, so you can adjust the podium as you like. And when you're ready, just state your name and the party you represent for the record, please.
May it please the court. I'm Paul Overson, and I represent the appellant, Todd Wilson, in this appeal. And what we're appealing is a trial court's decree dated March 5th, 2018, and the trial court judge was Ellen Moss in Washington County. On appeal, appellant contends that the trial court erred in several respects. One was erring in imposing unrealistic timelines on the appellant, having to do with the payments he had or has to make to the respondent, Ms. Wilson, relating to the homestead, a business buyout, and an equalizer. On the cross appeal, the respondent contends that those awards should be more highly collateralized. The appellant, second of all, contends that the trial court abused its discretion in ordering assets owned by the business, which I'll get into, to be divided on a 50-50 basis when the business itself was ordered divided on a 70-30 basis in favor of the appellant. The respondent contends in the cross appeal that it should be 50-50 on everything. There was a business cash that was routinely saved in a safe at the business premises. Appellant contends that trial court abused his discretion in allocating half of that cash to the respondent, Ms. Wilson. It was cash owned by the business itself and was on hand to pay ongoing expenses. The appellant also contends that trial court erred in his valuation of certain assets, which I'll get into briefly. And finally, we're addressing an issue of attorney fees that were ordered for conduct-based attorney fees because appellant sought to remove the trial court for perceived bias. The respondent in cross appeal contends that the award wasn't enough. Briefly on the facts, the parties were married in 2004. Both parties waived spousal maintenance, so the case only involves property division. And the big issue in the case had to do with a business that Mr. Wilson owned before the marriage, and that was called Minnesota Residential Aquatics, Inc., a Minnesota corporation. First of all, Mr. Wilson contended and testified that at the time of trial, the parties were under audit for their tax returns for 2014 through 16. He asked the court to put off the trial until his audits were resolved. The audits actually did later result in a reduction, we contend, in the value of the business by $60,000, but the trial court refused to delay the trial so the audits could be completed.
Are you challenging that?
Mr.
I didn't see that in the briefs, but...
It's not in the brief, no. It's one of the circumstances that relates to how the overall award isn't fair.
Can we, since you're talking about the business, why don't we focus on that for a moment?
Sure.
What case law do you rely on for the proposition that 50-50 had to govern all the assets of the business? And that, or 70-30, excuse me. You actually, you're arguing for a 70-30 split, right?
Right.
And challenging the 50-50 on some of the property.
Correct. I assert that we need to deal with the business separately from the other personal type assets. The business is its own entity. Under Court of Appeals decisions, under Supreme Court decisions, a corporation is treated as a separate entity from its owners.
But even so, which I think that the, it would, I think that property, although it's surprising to me that the jewelry and so on would be business property, but I think that was assumed by the expert and by the court and the parties to be business property. That's one example of the property you're talking about, right? That
yes,
was split 50-50.
The parties are, both of them were a part of this in having the company buy assets. The jewelry is an example of one that doesn't on its face appear to have a business relationship, but that's how they were purchased, and that was somewhat at the urging of Ms.
Right, so that it was considered to everyone to be a business asset, so we'll just accept that for purposes of argument. But why, what makes it an abuse of discretion to decide that some business assets would be 50-50 and the business itself, the rest of the going concern, would be a 70-30 split? What case law can you point us to that tells us that, that or statute, that tells us that that is an abuse of discretion?
Well, the case law I have is Remmel versus New Brunswick Fire Insurance Company, cited in the brief, that states that the property and rights of a corporation belong to it as a legal entity distinct from its stockholders. And the case is not on point in the sense of addressing a divorce between people, but it's pretty clear in its language that it's a separate legal entity, and it owns the, in our case, it owns these things. The jewelry
was your argument that none of the business property should have been distributed in the dissolution because it's a separate entity?
That it should have been.
And that seems where that case takes you.
Yes. But it, as it worked out, and the award was for the jewelry to remain with Ms. Wilson and for some other things. One example besides the jewelry was this race car. It's a drag racing car that had company logos all over it, a license plate, not a real license plate, it's not street legal, that said Pool Man or something like that. So he used that for company purposes to promote the business to people who attend these drag races.
Right, but you're not disputing that the business should have been split. You're just saying that the ratio had to be identical for all business assets.
Yes.
These physical assets as well as the rest of the going concern of the business. And it sounds like that and I, in your brief, I think you relied mostly on this statute. I don't know that you have case law that you could point us to, and maybe you just say, well, this is a new issue,
yes,
where
sir.
A district court can't make a different decision about business assets, split some 60-40, split some 70-30, some 50-50.
Right. I don't have any case law that specifically addresses the issue in the context of a marriage dissolution.
And why wasn't it, I mean, I think an argument that it makes logical sense that there was a 70-30 split on the rest of the going concern had to do with your client's more compromised earning capacity in the future, right? I mean,
right.
That was part of it. But in terms of the physical assets that already exist, like the race car and the jewelry and so forth, why wouldn't a 50-50 split make sense for those?
Well, again, I contend that it's a separate entity.
Okay.
It owned these things. The jewelry is a harder case. The vehicles, the trailer, some of these other things have more to do with the business.
Okay.
And should be within that category, I would assert, of 70-30.
Let's talk for a moment about the cash that you say that was in the safe, that was valued by, you know, identified by the expert as of the valuation date. And you're saying that cash, I think you make a couple arguments. One I wanted to ask about. In your brief, you say that actually there was not that amount of cash on hand as of the valuation date. But I didn't find in the record the evidence or testimony that would support that as of the valuation date, the amount of cash was different from what?
Well,
do you know? I don't need you to, you have short time, but do you know off the top of your head?
Top of my head, but it was my understanding that it was different, and that's addressed in the brief. The court found that the cash balance was $256,003 as of the date of valuation. And then there was some non-marital aspect, so it knocked it down a bit. And then the court found that there was a, I believe it was a cash. I think the cash was in the neighborhood of a...
like 204, maybe?
Yes, that sounds correct.
And and I think your argument then with respect to that is that really that that figure was, that those were business dollars, they were earmarked for future expenses of the business, including your client's salary in the upcoming fiscal year. My question for you is there any documentary evidence? I know there's testimony from your client about this cash. Is there any documentary evidence that reflects that this cash was treated as a business asset? For example, did it appear on a balance sheet? Did it appear on a tax return, so forth, of the business?
Mr. Hargis was an expert witness that tracked everything, and he testified at length at trial, and certainly did a good job of tracking things, not really contending otherwise. So he would have looked at that, and the idea of having him testify was so that the court would have an expert to lean on, and she was free to call him and ask questions if she wanted to, but that didn't happen, but that's certainly within the court's discretion. But he tracked that and came to that number as to the cash. Now, there's a little history of the whole cash issue. And in 2013, the parties were having a rough patch in your marriage. And the respondent, Ms. Wilson, went into the safe and took $100,000 cash out of there. And then she used that as leverage to extract a prenuptial or a postnuptial agreement from Mr. Wilson and then return the cash in consideration of that. Fast forward 2 years, and she filed for divorce, I think a day after the time frame set forth in the postnuptial agreement expired. So it's Mr. Wilson's contention that whole arrangement was rather planned ahead of time by Ms. Wilson. And then there's allegations, keep in mind that she's saying right before the divorce, he moved assets around in an effort to frustrate her in the divorce. Now, he contends and testified at trial, and I would argue quite convincingly, credibly, that no, he was trying to save the marriage. She always had concerns about the house being paid off, so he paid off
and,
the house.
And the facts that you're asserting now, what issue do they go to? What argument are you making? Are we still talking about the cash in the safe?
Well, they all kind of tie in together, but as far as the cash goes, that cash is at the end of the season in November when all the pool work is done, and the business is all he has then at that point is bookkeeping and planning for next year. And but his salary, he has to keep paying himself a salary and his son his salary and website maintenance expenses and things like that and to gear up.
Should that cash have appeared on any documents related to the business, any of the business documents? And if so, did it?
Well, I'm not sure as far as what Mr. Hargis looked at.
Did Mr. Hargis consider it a business asset?
The cash?
Yeah.
They, as I understand, didn't really render an opinion as to whether it was business or not. I would certainly assert this is money from selling pool things and services. And the cash comes in, it's held in the safe, which isn't illegal or anything. And
no, I'm not suggesting that. I'm just trying to look. I didn't think that Mr. Hargis addressed that. I didn't think that. So we can't rely on his report as saying it's a business asset.
But everybody agrees there was X amount of cash
right.
In the safe.
I think you should address perhaps the timelines, which is your first identified issue before you run out of time
okay.
here.
Yes.
So let's hear about what's wrong with the timelines.
What's wrong with the timelines is for him to pay her the house equity within 90 days is unreasonable. He needs that house to run the business from. And
why is that? Is it what record evidence is there that the house that particular house is necessary for the business? Is it something more than a home office?
It's a home office, but quite substantial.
What does that mean? What does the record show about the home office?
Well, I don't think the record shows a great deal about how much the home is used for the business.
Okay.
But he has the entire computer network. There's some level, as I understand it, I'm not sure it was brought up in testimony, as to inventory there. And it'd be difficult to move all that to a different location.
But there's not record evidence about inventory or?
No.
Okay.
No.
The district court, with respect to that, Mr. Overson, talked about he could take a mortgage and get the money in that fashion, presumably.
He would perhaps be able to. But why not just give him a bit more time to give her the homestead equity? She has her own home that she doesn't even have, as I understand it, to pay rent or anything. A nice home that, so she doesn't have a housing need or need money to buy a house right away.
Sometimes there's a desire for finality of a dissolution rather than extending it over, you know, right, a 5 or 10 year period.
Yes. The other thing is, that's true, but then we have two other things being lumped on top of this, and that's the business buyout and the cash equalizer. Any one of those things is difficult, any one of the three. You add all three in together, and it's, we assert, impossible for him to be able to accomplish
this. What's the total of all three?
Almost 500,000. The high 400, certainly.
In 90 days?
One of them is 3 years.
What does he have to pay in 90 days?
The equalizer and the household home equity.
And that is what amount?
370 or so.
Thank you.
Is that right? Well, we can ask that.
Well, it's all laid out.
It's all laid out. Okay. You'll have a time for rebuttal. Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Kevin Sandstrom. I'm here representing the respondent, Kathleen Wilson. I think to a large degree, I think both sides have pointed out that many of the valuation issues in this case are largely discretional, and I don't want to waste a lot of time talking about the exact value of assets that was raised in the appellant's brief. So what I'd like to focus on is the business. I think that's the biggest ticket issue here. And the 70-30 disparate split of that business and the rationale as to why we believe that was an abuse of discretion by the trial court in making that decision. And the facts that stick out in my mind and really jump out at me are the rationale for the trial court's decision seems to be in large part claims that the appellant had these physical and or mental limitations that limited his ability to work and somehow limited his ability to earn income. But that's not really supported by the record in terms of the actual income he was earning. If we look at the facts of this business, as well as the facts of Mr. Wilson's medical history, if you look at his testimony on page 388 to 390 of the transcript, he got his first back surgery in 2002. That was a discectomy in his low back, I believe, at that point. So you're talking about a guy who starts undergoing all this significant medical treatment in 2002. That's 2 years before this marriage even occurs. And then what we see in terms of the business is, at the date of marriage, which is in 2004, the expert witness values the business at $83,000. And so marriage starts. Mr. Wilson already has significant medical issues at that point, and the business is valued at only $83,000. And what we see in the courts, throughout the course of the testimony, as well as in the court's explicit findings, was at finding of fact number 38, the trial court says, it is undisputed that the business grew significantly during the party's marriage. So from 2002 to 2015, when Mr. Wilson is suffering all these various medical issues, the business is growing. It's doing great. He's earning significantly more than he ever did in the past, to the point that the expert witness, Mr. Hargis, when he's independently valuing this business as of the date of dissolution, he determines this business is now worth $360,000. It's worth nearly four times what it was at the time these parties got married. Actually, sorry, more than four times what it was worth when they were married. And this is the same period of time in which this guy is going through multiple back surgeries, multiple neck surgeries, shoulder surgery.
Let me understand your legal argument around this. Are you saying it's legal? I mean, what the court found in that same finding of fact is that respondents' health and involvement in the physical operations has greatly declined in recent years, and then describes about physical deterioration and so on. So it's right. Looking, the court's looking prospectively, I think, at earning capacity relative to that. Are you saying that's a legal error to do that, to look forward, or are you saying that there's a factual finding that's clearly erroneous?
I think that factual finding is clearly erroneous.
Which factual finding, then?
The combination of claiming that Mr. Wilson has some decreased earning capacity, when in fact his earning capacity is increased dramatically during the course of the marriage by the increasing revenues and value of this business, so despite the fact he's going through all these medical issues. I mean, these medical issues are not new as of the date of marriage. And the undisputed testimony was, in fact, that in the recent years leading up to the divorce, he wasn't doing the physical labor of the business. He's primarily running the office.
So what precisely is the factual error, the clear error?
Well, the error is the rationale used by the trial court, where every other asset in this divorce case is divided on a 50-50 basis, yet the court says, as to this business asset, it's fully awarded to Mr. Wilson. He has the full benefit of income from that going on years into the future, yet somehow the court's rationale is his physical disability limits his ability to earn income. But that's not supported by the record, because he hasn't been physically working in the business for years, as is stated in the testimony. He's operating the office, and that's a valuable component to this business, and in fact has made the business more valuable during the course of the marriage than it was years prior when he was doing the physical labor. And so there's a distinct contradiction and error in the court's findings when we're comparing the value of the business from before the marriage as opposed to during the marriage, which is exactly also when Mr. Wilson is suffering all these back issues and neck issues and going through surgeries.
Okay, so your argument is that future earning capacity is clear error to find any sort of impairment of future earning capacity because the past shows that his physical impairment hasn't affected earning capacity.
Exactly.
What about the mental health issues that are in that same finding?
Well, again, I don't recall the timeline of when he claims those mental health issues cropped up, but the reality is that as of the time that this divorce is occurring and continuing on after the divorce, he's continued to operate the business. I don't think there's ever been an allegation that he could not run the business or that the business had a decrease in earnings. This business has gone nothing but up. And so this argument from Mr. Wilson that somehow he's physically or mentally incapacitated from operating the business just isn't supported by the facts. He put in a whole bunch of medical records, but the business itself tells the story. The business itself is the proof. The business is doing better than it ever has. And so what exactly is his decreased earning capacity when at 54 years old, his business is doing great, and that's his source of income? He's self-employed. He's got his sons and or other employees to do the physical aspects of the job, and that's been the case for years. And so I think that's the distinct error in the court's rationale for dividing that asset in a disparate manner, whereas every other asset in this case is divided on a 50-50 basis. I just don't think there's a good rationale on the part of the trial court for why it did that, and it really ends up being a $55,000 detriment to my client and a $55,000 benefit to Mr. Wilson when that disparate division of assets occurs. The other issue, of course, that's a big problem for my client is this issue of the fact that her property equalization payment is not collateralized in any way. And to correct, I think, what Mr. Overson was saying, I do believe the total payment that is due to her is roughly $267,000. Under the equalizer formula, and I believe that includes the homestead equity. That's all laid out in finding of fact number 23 at the very end of the court's, or towards the end of the court's findings. And so if you look at, conclusion of law, number 23, the cash equalizer payment of $267,000 does include my client's share of $107,000 in the homestead equity. And so we're talking
about... What case law would you rely on that would tell us that we should reverse a district court's exercise of discretion with respect to the collateralization?
Well, and I'm sorry, it's noted in my brief. Let me pull that up for you.
And pinpoint what the abuse is here.
Well, I mean, the primary concern and issue, obviously, is there is no guarantee that my client is going to get this money. And frankly, part of the rationale of the trial court may well have been that she's ordered this payment to be made within 60 days and or 90 days. There's a typographical error in the order that says this is supposed to be paid
promptly.
The word
is 60 and
the word is 60 and the
90.
Yeah, the digit is written as 90. But, you know, part of the trial court's rationale may well have been, well, there's not a need for collateralization when this payment is due in such a short time frame. But the practical reality here is that my client hasn't...
What was due in a short time frame? Wasn't that the
cash equalizer payment of the entire $267,000 was due within 60 or 90 days, depending upon how you read that order, you read the word or the digit. But by virtue of filing this appeal, Mr. Wilson hasn't paid a penny to my client throughout the course of these appellate proceedings, nor has he even paid back the $25,000 he took from my client's son from his educational account. What he clearly admits was an error and a mistake on his part, and he owed the money back, and the court says he owes the money back. He hasn't even paid that back. And this
so is the argument that they're always... If there's an equalizer payment, it must always be collateralized, or it's an abuse of discretion. I'm trying to
that would be our argument, Your Honor, that there needs to be some security afforded when there's these large property equalization payments that are due. Otherwise, basically, my client is left with a judgment, an unsecured judgment, and no real way to collect it. I mean, a lot of these assets are intangible assets and/or retirement assets, and arguably. Exempt from potential collection in a judgment collection process, whether it's garnishment or things of that nature. Retirement assets are generally exempt, homestead equity generally exempt, unless the court specifically puts a lien in place against those assets as part of its judgment and decree. And so without that specific collateralization, my client is left unsecured and really has very little way of effectively collecting this amount from Mr. Wilson, and a fact that a reality that he now flaunts by having not paid anything to my client for now more than a year beyond the date of the judgment, and certainly continuing onwards as these appellate proceedings continue on. And so now more than a year down the road, the other no money having been paid and really no end in sight as far as where this matter goes from here. And so collateralization is obviously an important issue in this case, in any case where a large property payment is owed to a party and they're otherwise not, there's not a good way for them to collect that money if there's no hammer over that other party to collect against their assets if they don't voluntarily pay it as ordered by the court.
And so, was the district court asked to include that element?
I believe that they were. In post-trial proceedings, we asked for additional collateralization to make sure that payment would be made, and it just was not awarded. But in part also, I think part of the issue was some of those post-trial issues were deferred by the trial court because this appeal was filed, and so you'll see in that post-trial order that was filed in, I believe, June following the decree, the court kind of says, I'm leaving a lot of these issues by the wayside because there's now an appeal going. And so she really just vacated conclusion of law number 19 and otherwise kind of left everything in the status quo while this court dealt with other issues. Regarding the time frame itself and that 90-day time frame, we argue that that is an appropriate time frame for payment. And as I think that this court has already pointed out, with a $267,000 payment due and owing, Mr. Wilson was awarded a homestead that was free and clear, that was valued as part of that process at roughly $315,000. He easily could go out and get a mortgage against that house. He'd still have an 85% loan-to-value ratio, even if he took out the full amount of the equalizer payment that was owed to my client. And so it's not as if he even would need to mortgage his house to the full extent in order to make that payment. notwithstanding or in addition to any cash assets that he might have on hand to help pay that equalizer payment. And so I don't think there really was any abuse of discretion or anything wrong that the court did in ordering prompt payment on the part of Mr. Wilson. And when I say prompt, within that 60 to 90 day time frame as ordered by the court. And part of what Mr. Overson and his client argue in this appeal is that those payments should be stretched over a period of many, many years. And that's simply not fair to my client. As I pointed out in the case law, when there's risks of potential for squandering or hiding assets, which I think is a real risk here, given Mr. Wilson's conduct that was shown at the very start of these divorce proceedings, that he has a tendency to spend money willy-nilly, and he's a tendency to try to shift assets around and hide them. And so that prompt payment time frame is well supported as necessary in this case. And frankly, he does have the ability to pay that. He doesn't have to sell his homestead. All he has to go and get a mortgage against his homestead to pay off that payment. And so we don't think that there's any abuse of discretion on the part of the trial court in ordering a relatively short time frame for payment. And we think that's supported by the Bolenbach case, the Keithan case, and the Watson case. It's cited in my briefings. As to the divvying out of the so-called business assets that really aren't business assets at all, I also don't think there's any error on the part of the...
Why don't you speak to the cash in
the
safe?
Sure, including the cash, that being an asset. But the testimony was basically that Mr. Wilson needed that money to pay himself a salary during winter months when he's not otherwise working. It's really just revenue of the business. It's income to him. The business isn't actively operating, and for the most part, it's just being used by Mr. Wilson to cover those months where he's not, his own personal expenses or things he needs to pay for. Mr. Overson notes perhaps there's some accounting work that you need to pay the accountant to do taxes, but certainly he's stockpiling hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash in this safe. You don't need $200,000 to pay an accountant to do your tax return at the end of the year. The reality is that money in the safe, the cash, is really just income to Mr. Wilson, so it was appropriate for the court to consider that separately. And she relied upon the testimony and the opinions of the expert witness, who Mr. Hargis is certainly a well-known CPA who does a lot of work in these sort of forensic accounting issues in divorce cases. Very bright guy, completely neutral in this situation. He wasn't advocating necessarily for one person or the other, and found that that was an appropriate way to characterize that cash.
Thank you.
And I think my time's up. I apologize.
No problem. Thank you, counsel. Any rebuttal?
The first issue on rebuttal, there's no finding or evidence to support the allegation that Mr. Wilson engaged in hiding assets. I would assert he was very forthcoming on everything and cooperative with providing everything Mr. Hargis asked for. The issue with the 70-30 split on the business, if that business fails, which given the financial detriments imposed upon my client, would be likely, what's he left with? Health issues, his back is a wreck. It's absolutely, it's like he's Evel Knievel after all of his accidents. But he can't get a job with any kind of physical labor to it, and his mental health issues are such that his testimony was, and there wasn't any testimony otherwise, that he's not really suited for working for other people. So if the business fails, he has a real problem on his hands.
But there's nothing in the record to support the suggestion the business will fail, is there? I mean, his sons are involved. He's not solely responsible for the business.
His sons are involved. He's not solely responsible for the work. I'm talking about failing because of these monumental financial obligations being put on him to pay Ms. Wilson from the business, especially if it's moved to a 50-50 instead of 70-30 basis. Mr. Wilson testified that if that were to happen, the business would fail. That's in the transcript. His health continues to decline. The argument about the business going up while his health was declining is nonsensical. At some point, a health decline is going to impact someone's ability to do work of any kind, whether it be physical or mental. If you're in pain all the time like he is, it's kind of hard to concentrate. It's only getting worse. Another thing about this business growing, he had to bring in his sons to run the business. So right there, he owes each of them, or he will, One of them already vested on his 10%, but 10% of the business to each of them was promised, and Ms. Wilson knew about that. There was testimony about that. So there was a price to the health decline and a price paid for this business growth. Now, one thing I'll point about, there were several cases, and it was rather odd that they all had the same percentages, but business awarded on an unequal basis of a 57%, 43% happened in three cases I cited in my brief. It was odd three cases have the same numbers like that, but they did. And our case involves 70-30, a bit more than that, but that's only on the business aspect. If we look at other assets and look at the whole picture, although I haven't computed that, I bet it's like that 57-43% overall. So it's not really like he's getting 70% of everything here. It's just on the business. And I assert that business should involve that cash because that's totally the business. Unlike, you can argue about jewelry and things, but that cash is from the business. And when the court orders him to give half of the cash to her, what that is basically an award of temporary spousal maintenance because it's his income, his wages, and he has to pay half of it, what else would you call that but maintenance, to his ex-wife. Spousal maintenance is waived in this case. So that's part of the reason why that issue should be dealt with him being awarded 70-30 on the cash. And actually, we contend the whole cash thing is business assets and should be reduced by 80%. On collateral, I assert that Ms. Wilson's kind of shooting herself in her own foot by asking for that. If he wants to save the business, he would have to get a loan. And if she has collateral in place, I don't know if he'd be able to get that loan. That would create some complications there. Finally, on the issue of attorney fees, we haven't addressed yet. Mr. Wilson, filed a motion and then argued it, I forget if it was on the first day of trial or a couple days before trial, asking the judge to recuse herself from the case because of bias. And that was based on his perception of bias from how he'd been treated in this case all the way up to then. Again, it was his perception of bias. And what else can you really have?
Was he represented by counsel?
Yes.
Okay. Well, doesn't the law say that simply because the court has ruled against you does not mean that the court is biased such that the court needs to recuse?
Right, but it wasn't just the court ruling against him, although that certainly was happening on every motion.
I'm just saying, I respect that your client felt bias, but the law establishes that that is not bias.
He had his perception of bias, and he was entitled under the, I believe it was Baskerville, to assert that. So we would ask that the award of attorney fees